So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our weekly Marriage Hour here on Trending. It is great to be with you. I'm Timory. You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. It's our Marriage Hour. We're going to deviate just a little bit from our Marriage Hour during the show because I will be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman in just a little bit. And if you know nothing about the Lieutenant Colonel, he's one of the top military and law enforcement trainers in the nation. And in fact, his writings are some of the required readings that many of our military personnel read. Not only is he a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, he also trains and works with our veterans and active duty members, as well as retired every day. So he'll be joining us in just a little bit, and we're going to talk about what he refers to as a new greatest generation when it comes to our soldiers, and we'll also talk about how serving changed his life and inspired his current work with training our military personnel. You're listening to Trending with Timory. A couple topics during our Marriage Hour. We're going to talk about why eating together builds a marriage. We often talk about why it's great to eat together as a family, but what about as a couple? Also, we're going to right now dive in. Oh my gosh, I have not heard a story like this that has kind of just made my blood boil and bring sorrow and confusion as to what's going on as bad as this one did recently. So if you follow the story, two couples in Southern California, in Los Angeles, have swapped babies after an IVF mix-up. Okay, so follow the story here. One of the women chooses to remain anonymous along with her biological child, and then the other couple has gone public and worked with the press on sharing their story. So here's the deal. Two couples decide to engage in vitro fertilization, IVF, also known as third-party reproduction. They engage these services, right? And what ends up happening is they conceive a child biologically that's biologically theirs. Well, when it comes to implant the embryo, that is a baby in the earliest stages of development, the baby is implanted in the wrong moms and vice versa. The baby then goes through all 9 months of the pregnancy, bonding and growing within the wrong biological mother, but all the less a mother who was loving that baby. The baby's then born, and for the first 2 months of those babies' lives, both of those babies are nourished and loved and have some of the most important days, weeks, and months. And when I say most important from the perspective of bonding as well as developmentally, with a mother that carried them gestationally. But one of the couples from Los Angeles, the father as well as the mother just knew something was up. Something was different. Something was wrong. And so at 2 months, they end up going and having a DNA test. And the baby that they have is not their biological old child that they had created via in vitro fertilization. They then contact that the physician as well as the embryology lab, and there was a mix-up. The moms received opposite babies. Well, over 2 months after the birth of the child, after 9 months carrying gestation of the babies, these moms then swap the babies after all of this. Now, the fertility clinic in LA is being sued, as is the embryology lab. Supposedly, things are all right now that these babies have been swapped to be with their biological parents created via in vitro fertilization. But are you with me here with how many things have gone wrong in this situation? We talk a lot about the problems with in vitro fertilization from the perspective of the church. One, that is that abortion is commonly part of the in vitro fertilization process. It's referred to as, quote, selective reduction, where a couple's trying to conceive, they're already struggling to conceive, it's already what I'd say a somewhat unfriendly, you might even say hostile environment to carrying a child and carrying a child to term if they've been struggling, maybe through multiple miscarriages or not conceiving at all. And so then we're putting a child in its early stages of development, it's somewhat vulnerable situation, and you could even say in a negligible life situation where many of these babies die. That's why they create so many so-called embryos, babies in the early stages of life. And that's why they try to see, well, how many are going to take? How many are going to keep developing? A bunch die because it's, again, not the most conducive environment. And then they go through the process of selective so-called reduction, which is abortion. And many babies are aborted in the process. Not to mention the whole idea that the conjugal act, the love between a husband and a wife, is not a part of this creation, but everything occurs within a petri dish. It's cold, it's sterile, and so many couples who aren't even people of faith, or who are people of faith but, you know, don't really turn to their faith when it comes to IVF. They just want a child so desperately, and maybe that's been you, or maybe that's someone you know. They talk about how cold and materialistic and hard the IVF process is on the couple, rather than the loving act of a husband and a wife. Not to mention the harmful damage it does to women, leading many women into early menopause and many other health issues that have actually taken many women's lives. And by the way, in vitro fertilization isn't even that successful. I've talked to many people who, years after IVF treatments, both successful and non-successful, some who have had children from it, some who have not, where mental health, depression, anxiety, and any number of health issues continue to impact them for years to come. But one of the perspectives that we don't talk about is the impact on the baby. Then toddler, child, teenager, adult well into their years, and what it was like for them of being what we could refer to as a donor-conceived child, a product of third-party reproduction, of in vitro fertilization. They may or may not have been raised with their biological parents. They may have been raised with, you know, parents who paid to have these children created and someone else donated the egg and the sperm. There's a project called the Anonymous Us Project. In fact, there's a whole book compiling the stories of many donor-conceived children, in vitro fertilization-conceived children, who tell their stories anonymously of what it is like for them to be a child who knows that they had someone who donated sperm and they could have 20, 30, 100 other siblings out there and they want to know them. Even though they never had any biological, any connection apart the fact that they have their DNA. They have their genetic makeup. They didn't carry them gestationally. They didn't raise them. They didn't birth them. Any of these things. These kids still want to know their parents. And they want to know all of their other siblings through third-party reproduction that there are. And so come to this story of these two babies who were, that quote, embryos, babies in early stages of life, were swapped before being implanted in the wombs. They go through the 9 months of developing. They're born. 2 months later, they figure out, oop, DNA tests, we've got the wrong kid, and they swap the kids. What's the impact on the child? From being removed from the mother who carried him or her gestationally from 9 months, and then birthed the child, and then spent all of that special, intimate, most important bonding and development time for those first 2 months. And then those poor parents thinking, okay, I want my biological child, but I love this child too. This whole story, this whole situation continues to spiral out of control when we talk about the process of in vitro fertilization. We have famous couples, to us individuals who are not famous, who are going through situations such as IVF. Okay, a boyfriend and girlfriend get together, they try to conceive a child because they're in a long-term relationship. Suddenly one person leaves and they want to destroy the leftover so-called frozen embryos, babies. And the other person wants to keep them because those are her children. She doesn't want them destroyed, or vice versa. We could go on and on about the disasters that in vitro fertilization are creating. Women whose bodies are being destroyed in the process of in vitro fertilization. You don't have to turn to religion, but religion has a whole lot to say to help us understand the moral precepts here. It's a lie that the culture is saying today. This idea that I deserve a baby because I desire a baby. Children are absolute gifts. Absolute gifts. And I think it's important to understand that even in the face of infertility, even in the face of being childless, just because someone, and this is so important, if you're struggling with fertility or you know someone who is, just because you've not been able to have a biological child, that does not mean that you do not have something to offer as a spiritual mother, a spiritual father. The world needs your spiritual motherhood and fatherhood. The tragedy and the challenge of infertility is real, but this in vitro fertilization is causing more problems for couples, health psychologically, spiritually, and it's creating a lifetime of intense confusion and regret and an ongoing life search for those kids who have been conceived via in vitro fertilization, donor conception, all of this. In fact, one of the testimonies in the book from the Anonymous Us Project talks about one woman who, when she found out years later, she was almost 50 when she found out that her biological, who she thought were her biological parents were not, that she was a product of IVF, and she would never know or find, because it's been so long, who her biological parents are, her so-called donors are. And she said she'd obsess over it and think about it all the time and wonder, you know, what siblings may I have? Who was my biological father? Kids deserve better than this. We shouldn't be turning to this crisis for children long into their life because we desire so deeply a baby. And I also want to mention that not every infertility crisis is solvable, but there are many that are. And there are many who, for some reason, we're not receiving the information about what's known as Napper technology, and we'll post a link on social media, that helps to get to the bottom of why women are struggling with infertility, what the underlying health issue, find real answers, and even paths to physical healing, and if not physical healing, helping to work through the piece of understanding what's going on with your body, what your options are, without third-party reproductive technologies that damage and destroy the mind, the body, the soul, and lead to a lifelong struggle for these babies. I pray for these children as well as their parents from this whole IVF mix-up swap in Los Angeles, California. And we have to pray that we stop turning to technology such as these. We turn to real answers and accept at times whether or not God is going to send the gift of a child. You're listening to Trending with Timmy here on Relevant Radio. You're joining us during our weekly marriage hour. We're going to get back to our marriage topics in just a bit. But I want to talk about Veterans Day. It's Veterans Day, and if you've served, currently serving, thank you for your service. Joining me now, in fact, on Veterans Day to talk about our service members is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army. You may know him. He's one of the top law enforcement and military trainers in the nation. He's written countless books, some of which are required reading for many military members. He has books including On Killing, The Assassination Generation, On Combat, all fantastic reads. I want to talk today, Lieutenant Colonel, about our veterans and the current trends you see among more recent Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans. Welcome to Trending.
Hi, Timory. Always good to be on board with you. You know, we got a new greatest generation rising up, Timory. You know, the World War II generation, they truly were the greatest generation. They were a product of 4 years of war. We're looking at 20 years of war. I'm biased. I have a son with 9 combat tours. They were spec ops, 6-month tours. They're still 4.5 years in the combat zone, which is longer than anybody would have done in America if you'd have went all the way through the war in the combat zone. And these kids are magnificent. And one of the things that troubles me is the idea that they're broken. And I just want to confront a couple of the myths. Some of your listeners, you've heard, you know, 22 veterans a day take their life. But we need to understand that veteran and combat veteran are two different things. During the 40s and 50s and 60s, early 70s, they drafted millions and millions of people. They were all veterans. The word veteran means anybody who served. Elvis Presley was drafted. He served 2 years. He was a veteran. If Elvis was alive today and took his life, God forbid, He would be one of those 22 veterans a day that take their life. Most of those veterans, and they want you to think it's all from the current war. It's an intentional kind of misrepresentation. There is a problem with suicide. Every suicide is a tragedy. We talked on your show before about the link between sleep deprivation and suicide as a new factor. Mm-hmm. But among every category and every group, suicides are up. But this idea, these 22 veterans a day, only one or two are from the current war. And so this image that they're all suicidal or homicidal, you know, around 20% of adult American males are veterans. And again, when you get up there in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, most of those people, the majority of them, the males, were veterans. So, you know, you hear things like, you know, 8% of prison population are veterans. Well, 20% of adult American males are veterans. So this some are in prison and need our help. Some are suicidal and need our help. But the idea that they're suicidal and homicidal, and worst of all, that they all have PTSD. I keep running into veterans who think there's something wrong with them because there's nothing wrong with them. So in my classes, I like to throw up a screenshot from the VA website. And about 16% of the veterans who deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan have PTSD. 11% of the ones who didn't deploy have PTSD. About 10% of the adult population, you push the right button, you get a post-traumatic response. But about 5% contract PTSD in the war zone. Now, the percent who apply for PTSD as disability is another subject. But the research there, about 5%, and almost nobody knows that. The British know it, the Canadians know it. I present at national, international psych conferences, and there's always some Canadian or Brit who says, oh, our troops are on 5% PTSD. Why are the Americans so much higher? They're not. So again, we've got 3 million Americans in this war. 5% of 3 million Americans is a lot of people. They deserve our support. And the key thing to understand is that we're darn good at treating PTSD. Mm-hmm. Most people have what we call post-traumatic growth. That's the greatest generation. Post-traumatic growth, a new magnificent generation rising up to the challenge.
I want to unpack that a little bit, Lieutenant Colonel, but for those who are just joining us today on Veterans Day, thank you for your service. If you have served us, a currently active or retired military personnel, joining me now is Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. He's a retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, and he's a top law enforcement and military trainer in the nation. In fact, many of his books are required reading for many military personnel. Lieutenant Colonel, you're talking about post-traumatic growth. Can you share what that is and how we're seeing this among our veterans today?
Sure. You know, just about any stressful event, you know, the Bible tells us, Romans chapter 5, we glory in tribulation. For tribulation work of patience, patience experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed. The idea that the bad things in life can make us stronger is not a new idea. Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill us only makes us stronger. Nietzsche stole that from the Bible. You know, 2,000 years before Nietzsche, in the New Testament, we see the same concept. We got to understand that those who have been in combat, they have been forged in the flames. And, you know, we'll talk later about what the military impact was on me and what it is on most people. And it really does give us a sense of something greater than ourselves. You know, I look back on my military time, I look at my high school time, and high school was hollow. It was empty. It was just selfish, self-centered life. When you go into the military, there's so much more. This empty world that you carry around suddenly fills up with meaning and guidance. But the idea of post-traumatic growth, I like to tell the story of Marcus Luttrell. A lot of people know about Marcus. He was in the movie Lone Survivor. It was about him, the book Lone Survivor. A Navy SEAL team deployed in Afghanistan. The entire team was wiped out. Marcus was captured. He was the only survivor. He was captured. He was tortured. Very bad things happened to Marcus Luttrell while he was captured and tortured. And he was recovered. And the movie was written about him. But Marcus Luttrell has a podcast called Team Never Quit. I was on his podcast a few years back, and I got his permission to talk about him. Across all the years, couldn't talk about him, now I can. I trained Marcus' unit before and after that incident. Now, we talk about post-traumatic stress like being overweight. Post-traumatic stress disorder is obese, is debilitating. A lot of us carry around a few extra pounds, but we're not obese. You know? A lot of people have post-traumatic stress, and with proper dynamics, it moves into post-traumatic growth. We're stronger from the experience. Post-traumatic stress disorder, we can treat it, and it grows into post-traumatic growth. But Marcus Luttrell's doc told me he came back from that incident, and he was 500 pounds PTSD, totally debilitated. A year later, he was 50 pounds PTSD. He wanted to deploy again with his unit, and he did, and it was a good thing. And I told him at the time, look how far you've come in just the last year. Your doc tells me you were 500 pounds PTSD. Now you're 50 pounds PTSD. Look how far you've come, and have confidence you've come farther. Today, Marcus tells us he is 100% post-traumatic stress-free and stronger from the experience. We just want people to know that medical science moves on. One of the worst myths out there is that PTSD is untreatable. It is not. We're darn good at treating it. We get better every day. Don't be content with a lifetime of mental illness. If you have PTSD, if you have loved ones who have it, don't think it's some kind of a lifetime curse. It can be treated, and you come out the other end stronger and what we call post-traumatic growth, and recognize the fact that, again, the Bible says that we glory in tribulation. Count it all glory, we're told, when tribulation comes upon us, because it can make us stronger.
You know, Lieutenant Colonel, it's incredible to hear this story. And if you're just joining us, he was telling the story of Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell. You may know him from the story of The Lone Survivor. Books, movies have been produced about his story. He was the lone survivor of his entire unit of Navy SEALs. And Lieutenant Colonel just shared that he trained them before and worked with them after. And, you know, it's easy for us to think about the brokenness of so many of our veterans, as you mentioned, the suicide rate, among other concerns surrounding PTSD. But you're telling a message of hope that if anyone's listening right now, and perhaps they're a spouse of a veteran or a veteran, like they know someone who's a veteran, that we're seeing many of our soldiers, especially from the Iraq and Afghanistan war, who are coming home with severe PTSD, but finding that it goes completely away with proper treatment and healing. This is incredible news. Where should current veterans go if they're experiencing this and they don't know where to start? Maybe they started with a little bit of treatment, but need to go further.
You know, the VA, the Veterans Administration, has really gotten better and better at this. And they tell us like this, 22 veterans a day. Remember, that counts a lot of other people. Who weren't combat veterans, but they've got that down now quite a bit to maybe 17, 18 currently. It's gone down, but every life is precious. The VA is getting better and better. Trust the Veterans Administration. The VA hotline, just go online and search for the VA hotline if you need immediate help. Go to the Veterans Administration, get help, have faith in that help, have faith that it can make you better. The VA has come to a system in recent years where you can find local providers. You can choose your own provider. Too many, you know, that psychiatrists have access to a lot of drugs and pills, and they tend to turn to that first. But the truth is that that the help isn't generally in a pill, and we want to turn towards people who have a good record of working with veterans, of working with law enforcement, of working with individuals who've been in this situation. And the VA system now allows you to find mental health providers in your own area and to work with them through the VA. I really tell people, try to avoid somebody whose only answer is to give you more medication. That the meds can help. We all need a little help sometimes. But the cognitive learning theory and other dynamics that we've used over time, EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprogramming, have been incredibly successful. Right. There's so many good programs in place. If one doesn't work, find one that does. Equine therapy. I'm a huge fan of what dogs can do for us. Not just the therapy dogs. They're amazing. But we were not meant to be alone. Dogs are pack animals. You know, you leave one dog at home alone, it's solitary confinement. You leave two dogs, they're a pack, they're okay. You see somebody walking in a park alone, you worry about him. He's walking his dog. He's okay. And he views himself as being okay, too. We can talk a lot more about those kind of things.
Fantastic. That's Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, retired Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Army, here with us on Veterans Day, sharing with us about our current veterans. If you are currently serving or have served, thank you for your service. We'll be back to talk about how serving changed his life and inspired his work today. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
You're joining us during our weekly marriage hour here on Trending. We're going to continue with our marriage topics, especially the importance of eating meals together as a married couple. We talk about the importance for the whole family and the kids, but let's talk about this for couples as well in just a little bit. It is Veterans Today, and I'd like to thank you if you have served this great nation or have served in the past. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman joins me now. He's retired from the United States Army. You may know him. He's the top law enforcement and military trainer in the nation. His books are required reading for many of our military members' personnel. And I'd like to talk a little bit. We were talking about the story of our veterans and the good news about our veterans. And you told the incredible story of Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell, how you actually trained him before and after his mission. If you missed that, you can listen to the podcast at relevantradio.com/trending and subscribe. But now I want to talk about your own story. You work so often with our military members. There had to have been something that inspired you to the work that you do today. Can you share how your own service changed your own life and how it inspired you in your current work for our military?
You know, Timory, my first book is on killing, and after that is a book on combat. And praise God, both of those on Amazon today, earlier today, were number one in one in military history, the one military science. Here they are decades after the books had come out. They're still floating up the top of the chart. These books were written in my quest for a deeper understanding of what's happening in combat, what's happening to the people around me. And what I want to tell you, a lot of people, a lot of young people in particular, if you look around you, your life is hollow. High school is all about yourself and your friends and bigger things just aren't even on your radar screen. I enlisted in 1974. It was at the 82nd Airborne Division, a young paratrooper, and it was alive and vibrant, and we had a mission, and we had a purpose, and we had a contribution to make. Then I wrote my book on killing, and then I wrote on combat after I retired, but then I wrote my book on spiritual combat. And my military time, Timory, was really a spiritual quest. And you know, on killing, we talk about how the Vietnam veterans were attacked. And it is true. They were spit on. They were called baby killer. It really did happen. The veteran today, in many ways, they're not villains. They're victims. They're damaged goods. They're not. They're a new greatest generation rising up. But we're all on a quest. We're all on a pilgrimage. And my pilgrimage really didn't achieve peace and fulfillment until I accepted Jesus as my Savior, until I became a Christian. And that's what On Spiritual Combat's about. So the military gave me a sense that there is something greater than myself, that that life doesn't have to be empty and hollow and selfish, that you dedicate yourself to greater good and a greater cause, that you could submit yourself to authority. And it's okay to obey orders, and it's okay to give orders. As I continued on that quest to find meaning in life, though, it really didn't come to fulfillment. I was going to night school as a young sergeant, en route, trying to get my two-year degree to go to OCS to become an officer. And I took a night school class, just a philosophy. It was Philosophy 101. And my professor was a local pastor, who had a degree at Duke University, a PhD at Duke University. Mm-hmm. And he brought me to understanding that the belief in God and following God's will and God's word is the rational thing to do. I came to God with my head first and then with my heart. And that's where life really began to have fulfillment. My marriage began to have deep, my wife prayed me into the Lord. Pretty girls, maybe taking more young men to the Lord than anything else out there. It's one of God's great tools is godly young women who grab us and guide us and pray for us. But really, it was this quest. So many kids right now, you're in high school or you got a job and you're working a job and what do you do at home? You got a few friends. And is that what life's all about? No, there's much more to it. Mm-hmm. And the first step forward is your community, your church, your community. But the next step forward is your nation and the armed forces. And, there was a time when almost every adult American male served 2 years in the military.
Right.
And again, when they talk about 22 veterans that take their life, they're talking about those folks mostly. God bless every one of them. Mm-hmm. But we've lost that today. We've lost that sense of something greater than ourselves. And I encourage everybody out there, if you find that hollowness in your life, and the military is one place to look. It really is a beautiful organization doing good work, even in the current administration in so many ways. But more than anything, I tell you that fulfillment, that meaning, that purpose you're seeking in life really exists only with God. And
it's
the only true
witness.
Peace, we fight for peace and we fight to keep our nation safe, but ultimately we will all die. The only true safety lies in giving our soul to God. And the only real peace this world will ever see is peace between man and God that was created by Jesus' sacrifice on the cross.
Amen.
So
Amen.
I think it's possible that I would never have come to the Lord without first submitting myself to authority in the military. I was a punk. I was an 18-year-old punk.
It sounds interesting. Yeah, yeah. It really humbled you. It sounds like everything from submitting to the authority, seeing the need for help and the missions that you yourselves were involved with, which is a stark contrast to the hollowness you mentioned prior to joining the military. I think that's very profound.
Oh, well said, Emery. Well said, Emery. And it is. All of us are out there trying to find meaning in life. And I tell you, there is great meaning in the military. There is great meaning in service to others. You're not doing it to get rich, although they got some nice bonuses right now. It's a nice chunk of cash to take care of problems. But nobody does this job for the money. And all of our first responders who are here on the front lines at home and all of our military who are prepared to deploy anywhere in the world, they have submitted to authority. They have accepted something greater than themselves. We talked on your show before about sleep deprivation, and the military is just beginning to figure out. Some of the military research says a sleep-deprived soldier can be up to 5 times more likely to take their life. It's not just one of the strongest dynamics in suicide. Is sleep deprivation is one of the most remediable. It's one of the factors that we can deal with immediately.
Do something.
But
about
on the
it.
First day of basic training, I learned a lesson my parents were never able to teach me. You can get immediately straight out of bed when the drill sergeant tells you to. Oh, Mom, give me another 5 minutes. Oh, Mom, I don't want to get up yet. No, when the drill sergeant says get up, you got the heck out of bed. And you learn one of life's great lessons.
Who's the drill sergeant? Your mom or the one in the military?
indeed. A great lesson taught on the first morning of the first day in the armed forces. You can get straight out of bed. Don't touch that snooze alarm.
Minute.
It's an evil little button that makes you relive the worst part of every day over and over again. But it really is a growth. And I tell you, Timory, if I had not, like I was an 18-year-old punk, and I joined the Army and realized if I could play this game, I could win this game. Why I volunteered for this? Why am I fighting these guys? I got the high and tight haircut. I started playing the game, and I loved every minute of it. It's a worthy, fulfilling, important dynamic that you volunteered for. 20 years of war, and nobody's been drafted into this war. The kids out there today have all volunteered in time of war to serve their nation. They're really magnificent. But what you get out of it is a sense of something far greater than yourself. Life is so bright and vivid and alive when you're in the midst of this group of individuals who are training and working and striving together. You know them deeper and fuller than anybody you will ever know for the rest of your life, except maybe your spouse or in a good bonded group of Christians as you work your way through your church. It really is what the first step on the process of understanding there's something greater than yourself and that
Lieutenant
it's good
Colonel,
to submit to authority.
Yeah, you discovered a greater purpose in your service in the United States Army as well as a meaning, and today you continue to work with our military personnel. Speak a little bit to how you work with our military personnel, especially in a culture that is increasingly faithless, to discover that greater purpose and meaning as you're training them on the topic of combat.
You know, it's funny you mention that, but on combat, the title of my book is On Combat, The Psychology and Physiology of Deadly Conflict in War and Peace, On Combat by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman. And in the book, I have what I call my spiritual ambush. Because partway through the book, I talk about the fact that you can be a Christian and be in the military. You know, and courage is, you know, I quote a chaplain that says, courage is a soldier who said his prayers, you know. And one of the first non-Jews, the first non-Jew we know of to become a Christian was Cornelius, a Roman centurion. And the Lord sent one of the disciples to him and said, Lord, are you sure this Gentile, this non-Christian can become, that this non-Jew can become a Christian? Lord said, yes. And I never once did he say it was inappropriate to be a Roman centurion and to be with God. Never once was even implied. There is great peace between Christianity and service to a greater cause and in our military. And the whole chapter of my book is what I call my spiritual ambush. And another way that we can talk about faith in the military is we talk about resiliency, and that's what I teach. I call the bulletproof mind resiliency, people who do not get PTSD, factors that make you psychologically stronger. And one of the pillars of resiliency is faith. It's a scientific fact. It's a foundational dynamic in the armed forces, that faith is one of the dynamics that allows you to endure hardship and be stronger from it. And the bottom line is you have to have a higher power to turn things over to. The only thing in the universe you can control is yourself right now. Everything else, you've got to let go of it, turn it over to God, have faith in God, and focus on the one thing you can control, and that's yourself and your ability to accept Jesus as your Savior and have a fulfilled life living through Him.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman here on Trending with Tim Ray. Lieutenant Colonel, thank you for your service and all the work you do with our military and law enforcement personnel. Please check out his books on killing and on combat. I'll be right back.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
I am so excited. Advent is right around the corner. It is my favorite liturgical season of the year. In fact, I already started talking about preparing for Advent. If you haven't listened to the podcast, you can listen now, relevantradio.com/trending, where you can download, subscribe to the podcast, share it with a friend, especially someone who maybe loves the Christmas season but hasn't quite pondered and understood what Advent is. Why does the priest wear purple, such as when he does during Lent? Did you know it's actually a time of preparation and penance for our Lord? It's like a mini Lent, but not quite. We'll unpack more preparing for Advent in the coming weeks. If there's something you've done for Advent, you'd like to share it, love to hear from you, maybe a meditation, whatever it might be. But it's hard to believe that Christmas is right around the corner. The real key to having a Merry Christmas starts with Advent. That's why we've been talking about it. Now, Advent begins Sunday, November 28th, and I have a free and simple way for you to grow in your faith this Advent. Sign up to receive Father Rocky's Advent Inspirations. They are short, daily audio reflections designed to help you delve into the beauty of the Advent season. These reflections are emailed to you each morning throughout Advent. They'll help you to start the day with a smile and give you something to ponder. You can sign up for Father Rocky's free Advent Inspirations now, that way you don't forget, at relevantradio.com/advent, or click on the banner on the Relevant Radio app if you're listening on the app now. You're listening to Trending with Timory during our weekly Marriage Hour, and again, it's Veterans Day. We were just visited by Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, an incredible man, incredible work he does. Please pray for him, pray for our veterans. If you have served this great nation currently or in the past, thank you for your service, and be assured of our prayers for you here at Relevant Radio. One of the topics I wanted to unpack today during our Marriage Hour has to do with the theme of eating together. We often hear, and if you haven't before, the importance of eating together as a family, trying to eat one meal a day. or at least a few a week, and how important it is for the development of relationships and socialization, of communication, collaboration, the family unit. But what we don't talk a lot about is also the importance of spouses eating together. There's a trend in our culture of all members of the family, especially spouses as well, who set the tone really for who will and will not eat dinner together within the home. And the trend is this coming and going that perpetually occurs. Work priorities, family priorities, extracurricular activities, youth group, different schedules, different times, almost leading to this never coming together. At a certain point, all the extra activities, the work, the means of providing can actually become a detriment for the whole family and especially for the marriage. Two ships passing in the wind become one spouse and the other. This can happen when you first get married. This can happen 30 years into your marriage, 15 years in, with kids or without kids. I found it fascinating, even in the short few years I've been married, to see the significance and importance of eating together. My family growing up, we always had at least one meal really together each day as was possible. But what happens when spouses stop eating together? Well, the children stop eating together. The spouses stop communicating, interacting. It's interesting. So when I first got married to my husband, I was working about four nights a week. And so we didn't really eat dinner together at night. So there was one night a week, it was Friday, that we had the opportunity to eat dinner together. And very quickly when we got married, it was a missed and obvious thing that we weren't having dinner together. So we really worked to make it a routine that we would have a nice breakfast every morning. Whatever it might be, nicely cooked, enjoyed, sat down, savored. It required us waking up a little sooner, not being so rushed in the morning, having enough time to cook and even cook together. And so I had a lot of opportunity to think about the importance of meals. And as schedules have changed and different timings with food have occurred, we try now to sit down and if we can, have two meals together a day, breakfast and dinner. And I find myself each time we sit down for that meal, take a big deep breath as soon as I sit down, it's on the table. About to dive into the next joy and sometimes even challenge of conversations, quality time, acts of service, physical touch, gift giving, verbal affirmation. I think meals are fascinating when you think about it. Have you ever heard about the five love languages? I feel like the men always know about the five love languages. They're like, yeah, she tells me her love language is receiving gifts. Another one says, oh yeah, mine is quality time. Another might say, oh, it's all five for her. Well, the five love languages are this. Basically, the premise is that we have a tank. And our tank can be full and us feel really loved, or our tank could be halfway full or completely empty and we not feel loved at all. And what fills up our love tank is the love language or two that appeals most to us. In other words, all of us have different characteristics, traits, gifts, but all of us have types of ways that we most appreciate and most need to be loved. And so the five love languages include quality time, acts of service, physical touch, and I'm not just talking about sex, gifts, and verbal affirmation. Now these five love languages, the idea is that maybe your family of origin wasn't a very huggy family, didn't really have a lot of physical contact. And you marry someone, a woman who comes from a very physically affectionate family. Physical touch is really important. It makes her feel loved. But you didn't grow up with a family like that. So you don't really, you know, hold hands. You don't really do any public displays of affection. You're not big on hugging and kissing as you leave, as you come and go. Well, her love tank is going to feel a little empty because that's something that's important to her. That's something that makes her feel loved, that affirms her love from you. But maybe you grew up in a family where you guys always did acts of service for each other. And so you're thinking, well, I'm doing all of these things for her. And why is it that she always is complaining and seems as if she doesn't appreciate the love I have for her? It isn't that she doesn't appreciate the acts of service. It's that she needs a little more physical touch. Yes, even a little bit of PDA. And so what I'm talking about all comes back to this whole idea of eating together. I think meals together as a couple can actually help solve a lot of the crises surrounding confusion about the need for filling up our love tanks. Because when you think about it, a meal allows so many opportunities, not just the opportunity for communication, but it allows for these five love languages to bud. And I think that this is part of the reason why dating, we feel so much better when we're dating, because not only are we being wooed, are we being more interesting or interested in one another, but a meal together and a lot of them, which usually occurs when you're dating someone, actually usually touches in one way or another on the five love languages. Quality time. You're sitting down together, having a quality meal, quality interaction. Especially for someone who needs face-to-face contact. Undistracted attention. That meal, remember, the meal should leave the cell phone out of the room, off the table, ringer off, whatever it needs to be. That quality time, it could make us someone sore who needs quality time. Acts of service. The actual making of a meal or taking someone out for a meal is in and of itself an act of service, paying for the bill. Physical touch. When you're sitting eating a meal, you can put your hand on the table and the other person can touch your hand. You can say thank you, it was a delicious meal. Give a hug or a kiss after it, showing your appreciation. Also, for people whose love language is receiving or giving gifts, you have the opportunity to give the gift of a meal. And in fact, many people who need to receive gifts, who love receiving gifts, you know, it could be simple little gifts. It could be even a surprise hidden note. Speaking of which, verbal affirmation is one of those five love languages. Verbal affirmation, it's perfect time. You can make sure you're affirming your spouse. Thank you for this meal. Thank you for helping to provide it, for making it. This thing tasted really good. If your spouse's love language is verbal affirmation, probably don't tell them that you don't like Brussels sprouts and the meal was too salty. Probably won't help. But see, I think that this is part of the power of meals. Meals can touch on all five of those love languages. It's an opportunity to fill up that love tank, especially if you know about these five love languages. And seeing and understanding a little bit as to why going out on dates, there was such a woo and appeal. Because we were sitting down for meals. Shared experiences of cooking, eating, cleaning up together, even screaming babies, burnt food, messy floors. That's actually something that's been a daily occurrence, actually, every single meal. The baby eats with us, and, well, she insists and prefers on feeding herself. She does a really great job, but Grant, she's barely 10 months old, so a lot of food does sort of end up on the floor and everywhere, and it's great, especially we were having salmon tonight, and she, like, rubs her face after eating the salmon and rubs her hair, and then if I'm picking something off of the floor, she likes to rub her greasy, nasty little hand in my hair. And, you know, you think about it, it can even lead when you're having a meal to you eat your meal and it's cold food because you've waited so long, because that's just how things happen. One person's late from work. The other person had to take a call, one of the kids needed something, but what matters is that you did it. Now, one of, I think, the final dimensions I do want to talk about, because I think it's so important and so fun. So many people say, you know, how do I do a date night? I can't go out. And they'll make, you know, kind of not just excuses, but also legitimate reasons for why you can't make the time to spend time with your spouse. Well, cooking together and having regular meals can be a part of helping make that happen. Doesn't matter if you can't cook, you can learn, or you can be the chopping assistant, the stir assistant, the dish cleanup. What matters is that you're in the kitchen together. Some really neat things have come out when we actually talk about married couples and cooking together. One of those things is that it actually helps the two of you together to collaborate in order to accomplish something. And so it's excellent collaboration accomplishment for the spouses together. We need accomplishments in our lives. We have them in our careers. We have them throughout the day. We have them in getting something cleaned or done. But how often do we actually do it together? Well, one of those things can be cooking together. It also provides an excellent opportunity for conversations. Ladies, if you have a hard time getting your husband to sit down face to face with you having a conversation, Well, this is a good reminder that men love to do things side by side. They do not prefer to make eye contact while they have conversations. They'd rather walk and talk. They'd rather hike and talk. They'd rather do dishes and talk. So cooking and dishes are a great time to talk side by side. It takes off the pressure for the poor men feeling awkward as you stare them down waiting for them to say something. Again, cooking allows that opportunity of cooperation. Hey, he might have an idea for spices or input. Just make sure he runs it by you first or vice versa if your spouse isn't a cooker. But it also sets an example for your kids of you as spouses working together, sharing in a new experience, giving input, being patient, doing things different ways to how you chop the cucumbers, to how much salt you put in the food. I think that one of the things that we have to revive in our homes is cooking together. Food, meals, feasts, they're all at the heart of the biblical story. From the Last Supper to the regular Eucharistic celebration, it's a meal. Passover, so many of the Jewish feasts, such as first fruits and others, it all surrounds food. Even Adam and Eve, the fall of Adam and Eve had to do with an apple, a piece of fruit. We have to turn back to eating together as spouses and setting the tone in our family. It'll be a sure way to grow your marriage, and I hope we'll hear some incredible stories from how eating together again helped reignite the fidelity and the joy within your own marriage. We'll be back tomorrow here on Trending. How do you stay Catholic when you're frustrated with the Pope or any number of leaders in the church? Someone recently asked me this, and I'll discuss this. This is Timmy from Trending with Timmy. Friday, I'm joined by celebrity and royal matchmaker Christina Pineda, taking your questions. Do you want to set up your kid or help them along in their dating life? Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.